1, 2, 3, 4.
Thanks for listening to this podcast produced by Diddy TV. Visit DiddyTV.com for more exclusive on-demand content or download the official Diddy TV app from your app store today. Welcome to Insights, everyone. Today, we're excited to have G-Love on the show, chatting with Amy Wright about his latest studio album, Philadelphia, Mississippi, an album that's heavy on collaboration with some of Delta Blues and hip-hop's most well-respected artists. Joined by players like Chris Stone, Kingfish Ingram, Jontavious Willis, Alvin Youngblood Hart, Chuck Treese, Schoolie D, and many more, Philadelphia, Mississippi is an important record for G-Love, as it connects his hometown of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, down to the heart of the Delta Blues, a sound that he's been voraciously obsessed with since he was a kid. We're excited to have him on the show today to chat about the album and to learn about his life, growing up in Philadelphia, and so much more. So without further ado, here's G-Love with Amy Wright on Insights.
What was it like growing up in Philly, and what was music like for you as a kid? I mean, when did you start playing music?
That's a loaded question. So I started playing music when I was 8 years old, and my mother put me in guitar lessons at a place called Settlement Music School. I studied folk guitar, and I was terrible and I hated it. And then when I was about 13, I could tune the guitar, and it actually started sounding pretty good. And by 15, I started writing songs and playing a harmonica on the rack, and that kind of went from there. So then how did Philadelphia like play into that? Like Philadelphia is, you know, like Memphis or other big cities, it's a melting pot. It's an East Coast melting pot. And I grew up right in the center city, by the street called South Street, which was like the Beale Street of, Philadelphia, right? That's where all the street musicians were and the street performers. So growing up as a kid in the 70s, you know, I was exposed to all this culture, like from all walks of life, you know, every different race and religion, you know, gay people, straight people, homeless people, rich people, white people, black people, every ethnicity, every different kind of food. And on the streets, it was very vibrant. Like there was musicians and there was magicians, and there was a guy that played like the Mozart on the wine glasses, and there's another guy that had a marionettes, and he had three marionettes. He had a Jimi Hendrix one, an Elton John one, and a Janis Joplin one. So he plays boombox and make the little handmade marionettes, like, you know, Foxy Lady. And I'll never forget it. And so that influenced me to become a street musician as a teenager. And that was kind of where I cut my teeth and cut my teeth as a performer, like being a street musician. So that kind of cultural impact, you know, being exposed to all that stuff and just being exposed to the fact that, like, wow, you do something creative. Here's your stage. It's right there on the corner. Go do your thing. You don't have to ask anybody. You just have the guts to sit out there on the street. And I did have that. And so that kind of was a big part of it. And then the last thing I'll say is Philadelphia was one of the epicenters of hip hop. So the hip hop culture was happening also when I was growing up, aside from my music, right? I was like writing graffiti and skateboarding and breakdancing and doing all this hip hop culture stuff and playing basketball. And I never thought that the hip hop side of my life would collide with like the folk blues side of my life. But then one day they did. And that's when, you know, I became G-Love. And that's specifically, I think, from growing up in Philadelphia, when I grew up there.
So was there ever anything else that you thought you wanted to do? I mean, you get out of high school. I know you went to college for a bit and then you decided, hey, I want to be a musician. But was there something else in there that you thought, hey, I think I'm going to be this? Or did you just know?
Yeah, like I kind of had that bug in my ear since I was like 16. Like and basically like the songwriting is the thing that changed my life. As far as like, you know, because I wanted to write the songs and I wanted to record the songs like just on my boombox or whatever. And then I wanted to perform the songs. And then once I just got into the performance capability. And honestly, the street performers thing, like the first time I went to play in the street, me and my buddies and my little girlfriend made like $20. We were like 16. Like, holy shit, we just made $20. It's 1986. Like, this is fucking awesome. Like, and then it was just like a thing, like, wow, like that was empowering, you know? And then I thought, like, wow, you know, like, I don't have to get a job. I don't have to go to college. Like, I could be a musician. Like, that was my passion. And so then I kind of like, also think about like people in my generation, you know, we didn't grow up with the internet. There's no home studio, right? The music business is like, it's like a somewhere in a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away type vibe. Like there's MTV, there's U2, there's Madonna, there's The Cure, you know, there's the Stray Cats, whatever. I'm saying like, there's no way to get from here to there. And as a matter of fact, like you couldn't, even if you made a demo tape or a record, you couldn't just send it to the record labels. Like they would not accept unsolicited demos, which means that you had to have your demo sent officially by a music industry attorney, whatever that was, or a music manager, wherever you could find that, right? So there was no way to get there, right? So, you know, you just had to find your baby steps. And what were they? For me, like playing on the street, getting some gigs, always seeing flyers for like, you know, demo competition or like the city paper, like looking the back of the city paper, manager seeks talent. You know what I mean? All these little kind of connecting the dots, like Hansel and Gretel to New York City to play for the labels, you know? But once I had the dream, it was like, yeah, I mean, I wanted to do it, you know?
Do you think there's a lot more freedom for artists now than there was then?
Like what do you mean? Like
ability to market yourself via the internet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you're like a savvy kid, or anybody, if you're computer savvy and like, yeah, I mean, look, like you, if you have everything figured out, cause you could do everything on your phone. Like you could, if you figure out how to make great movies, then you can make your own great videos. And then if you figure out, you know, how to really work all the social media opportunities and make awesome hype. Yeah. You could do all the marketing yourself. So the successful people are like, and you can obviously like make hit records at home, like Billie Eilish, right? Her and her brother were just like teenagers, like, and they made, making hit records in their bedroom. So there's the possibility to have like huge success with really just out of nowhere. And that's really interesting. And that's unique to the generations that have grown up with the internet, you know? And, but it's also super daunting, right? Because when I got signed, you have to like go find a way to get to the label. But then if you got signed, right, you're one of like a generally small amount of records that are going to come out that year as, you know, like, whereas now, like we have to just consider that maybe on this very moment, there's, you know, 1,000 records just dropped right the second, you know what I mean? Because anybody can make a record and anybody can put it out themselves. So I think about like, if you were like a new artist, like starting right now, it's pretty daunting to think about like, how are you going to cut through the noise, you know?
Well, I think that like, to your point, there's pluses and minuses for both time periods. There was a lot more artist development by the labels back 80s and 90s. And then now there's less of that if you're not signed. And so, you know, there's a mixed bag on either end. But let's go back to Boston. You leave Philly, you move to Boston, and you start busking, you started playing in clubs. There was The Plow and the Stars.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you had a Monday night gig there that was ongoing, kind of a house band. What did that do for your career? And then tell me a little bit about becoming G-Love and Special Sauce, because that happened there, right?
Yeah, so basically... I met my drummer at a Irish bar, and we put together the band, and there's another band in town called Morphine, who I'm sure you're familiar with. And Mark Sandman was a lead guy, and actually, rest in peace, Mark. You know, he passed away years ago. But his girlfriend, I had a real crush on her as a 20-year-old. She was probably 26. I don't know, Mark was in his 30s, whatever. And so she thought it was cute that this little kid had a crush on her. So she told Mark about me, and then Mark kind of took me under his wing. And well, they got signed their deal with Ryko Disc. He said, well, call Noel over at the Plowing Stars and ask for our Monday night. So that started our residency. And it's a small little Irish, typical Irish pub in Cambridge, you know, probably holds 150 people, corner bar. And yeah, that was the deal. We get paid $125, three sandwiches, and all the Guinness you could drink until they found out 20 years old. And then it was $125, three sandwiches, and no Guinness for me until the doors were closed. So, but we had to play, and we played three sets. So, you know, so that was, yeah. So then we, you know, bring our own PA in, set up. And the first Monday night we loaded in, the bar regulars kind of looked at us. And they, I remember one guy was like, we don't like your kind of music. And I was like, well, let us set up and play. He didn't even hear us play. He's like, I don't like your music. I don't like your kind of music. You don't even know what we do. You never even seen us play. So then we played a show, you know, by the end of the first night, we had them all dancing, and then it just took off, like, from that first Monday, then there would be, start to be a line down the block. And then, and so we did it for like that first year in 93, until we went and made a record and stuff every Monday night. And, it would be packed down the street, and we'd still make the, I think they gave us a raise to $150, three sandwiches, and all the beer you could drink after closing time.
Listen, when you're 20-something, the sandwiches are very important. I'm just saying. I know. So you had Jeffrey Clemons, he's your drummer and bassist. You had Jim Prescott. And when did you become G Love and Special Sauce? And I know your sound is pretty unique because you're kind of a combination of blues and funk and hip hop and everything else. So, did that just immediately gel when you grabbed these two guys?
Yeah, honestly, there's a recording of our first rehearsal that Jeff has, and it was the sound of my dobro, Jimmy Jazz's acoustic upright bass, and Jeff playing on an empty beer box with the brushes. And that was kind of the sound. It was an immediate sound of like the wood tones. And Jeff was kind of the older brother, kind of, you know, kind of like disciplinary guy in the band. And he would always encourage us to make a lot of space in the music so that the space in between the notes, right, is what becomes even more important than the notes that you play, right? So it had a real open sound. And as a trio, it had an open sound. So there was like a sound like right away. And then what I was doing as a songwriter and kind of fell into, you know, doing these blues kind of riffs off the Delta blues that I was learning from Robert Johnson and, you know, Lightning Hopkins records. And then the hip hop that I grew up listening to and was my music of my generation, like Tribe Called Quest and Eric B. and Rakim and Gangstar and Boogie Down Productions and stuff like that. Like, it was really organic. And I would like sit with Jeff in his truck and I'd play him my hip hop, and then he'd say, oh, that's a Funky Meters sample, or that's a Cool in the Gang sample. And I said, who are the Meters, you know? Who's Cool in the Gang? Oh, that Celebration Band, you know. So he knew where the music that I was loving was coming from, right? And so that in that way, hip hop was interesting to him. And as a drummer, he liked the beats that the hip hop producers were making. And so we had But so then, so the naming of the band, like, yeah, we right away we went to play our first gig. Well, what Jeff said, well, what do you want to call the band? Well, I was already calling myself G Love by then, so I go, well, I'd always wanted to have a band called Special Sauce. So I said, I want to call the band Special Sauce. And then he goes, well, it's got to be G Love and something. I said, we'll call it G Love and Special Sauce. And then we got. And then I got signed to record deal as G Love. He goes, well, how come it's all about you? I said, you're the motherfucker that want to call it G Love. It's your fault. Yeah, don't be mad.
Okay, so Tom DeMille, he's a producer. And then what was his role in all of this? And I know you got signed eventually. So tell me about that.
Wow, that's really digging in the crates. Thank you. I mean, Tom was, how did I meet Tom? I'm trying to think how we even connected. It might have even been through like an ad, like a flyer that I put up like with Tear Offs. But he had a little home studio rig in his attic where it was smelled like skunk to me. Later I found out he had one of those like marijuana growing capsules. It was crazy. Like we made a bunch of demos and he was like a keyboard player. So, we made a cool little demo. And it was really cool because I had this demo that sounded pretty professionally produced. And so when I met Jeff, my drummer, I played him the demo and he was like, oh, okay, you know, this kid's serious. Like he's actually got like a pretty legitimate demo. So Tom, and then Tom recorded the Special Sauce, doing like a live session in my apartment in Brighton or in Alston in Boston. And, so he kind of helped me early on. And then I met the band and then I kind of went on and did my thing. So he wasn't part of the Special Sauce, but he was like my first producer that I worked with. Amy, I just got to go check the 1-year-old. He's wailing. Okay. I'll just be right back. Okay. Here you go. You got a guest star. This is June.
Oh, what's his name?
His name is June.
June.
He was born on the 15th. He just turned one.
Hey, I'm a June 10th baby. So.
Oh, I love it.
Hi, June. Is it nice to be there with your daddy? Oh, look at that. Lots of love. Lots of G love to be had, right? There we go. Okay. So I think he's going to answer for you on a couple of things. I'm feeling it. So tell me about getting signed to a label. What was that like for you? And how did everything change? Once you got signed?
I mean, Amy, I remember like the moment, like we were sitting in Jeff's like studio apartment in Alston. And we got the call from the guy who was managing us at the time. And the deal's going through, you know, we're signing with Epic. And I started crying because I was like, wow, it was like a dream come true. But here I was having this amazing, like really like the best year of my life ever in Boston as a street musician. And then, you know, playing the local bars and I fell in love with this woman named Nancy and I had a best friend and I had a 1963 Dodge Dart and I had an attic apartment above the old man's bar in Brighton Center and things couldn't have looked any brighter for me. I was like living the best life and having this time of my life and I just remember like being like, wow, like everything's about to change and I didn't know what was going to happen, but I just knew everything was never going to be the same again. And then, you know, it wasn't. So it was like hitting the lottery and jumping off this cliff into the abyss. But we also went from being like on the fringe of society as street musicians to like working for one of the biggest corporations in the world, which was, you know, Sony Music. So, you know, that was just an unbelievable thing. And yes, he's taking the bottle. So it was, I'll just never forget the moment, you know. And then, yeah, and then we put that record out and we hit the road, and then we basically, you know, we're toured nonstop till like COVID hit, and then actually got to catch our breath.
So you're touring, and you're you know, out there, you're doing your thing, and you also met Jack Johnson along the way, and you put out an album with a song on it, Rodeo Clowns, and I know that he went on to also put out that same song. So how did you meet Jack? And I just was curious about that.
Yeah, that was it's been such a wonderful friendship, and meeting Jack when we did, and kind of like having, you know, I'm quite sure that he would have been fine if he never met us, but like, you know, I'm lucky to say that I kind of discovered him and put him out there to the world. And I'm proud of that fact, because I continuously to this day, I recognize talent and I recognize greatness. And I recognize that in Jack from the minute I sat with them. But the story was like, basically, my little sister's ex-boyfriend from the Jersey Shore, a surfing buddy of mine named Scott Sowens, when I got signed, and because I grew up in Philly, but we grew up also at the Jersey Shore in this little surf town. And when I got signed, like a lot of the kids, like the younger generation kids, kind of saw different opportunities than maybe their life would have gone. And one of them went on to be the two brothers. They run the Obey clothing line with Shepherd Ferry. And Scott Sowens went on to be a great surf and skate photographer. And so he had moved out to California and started working with all these surfers and stuff. So I was out in California making my fourth record, Philadelphonic. He goes, "Hey, Garrett, there's this guy that I work with, and his name's Jack Johnson. He's got this awesome song, Rodeo Clowns. I think you should hear it. And he's a big fan. Can we come by the studio?" I said, "Sure, come by." So they came by. We went for a surf, and then we sat in my crappy hotel room at Topanga Canyon Ranch Motel that afternoon and traded songs. And I just remember thinking, wow, like, every song that this kid played was like so beautiful, and the lyrics and the chord progressions. And I was like, you know, it was just one of those moments. Like, wow, what's going on? So then I left there he left there. He gave me his demo, and I played it for our producer, T-Ray, who was like a hip hop producer. And he was just coming off working with Carlos Santana on the follow up for the Supernatural record. So he was hot. And I played him the Rodeo Clown song. And it just had this kind of like really timely kind of feel that kind of represented just that kind of generation of kids that were like a couple years younger than me. And just remember thinking, like, you know, because the lyrics, like the belly button rings and, you know, like just these different things that were popular at the time. And anyways, I asked Jack, I was like, "Yo, can I record that song?" And then he goes, "Well, I got to think about it." And I was like, "Well, don't think too long, because we got a studio tomorrow." So he called me back and he goes, "Well, could we do it as a duet?" And I said, "Well, I hadn't done any kind of collaborations with anybody since like my rapping partner, Jasper, on my first couple records." Well, I said, "All right, okay, fine. So let's do it." And then we went in the studio the next day, and he was so on it. Like he nailed it in the first take. Like T-Ray put up a hip hop beat. We both sat down with the acoustics. He sang it live. I played the guitar solo. He put a double on his vocal, then a harmony. And then we basically had the track except for my vocal. And I was like, wow, this kid is fucking great. And then I was like, I got cold feet. And I was like, "Jack, man, I think you should just take this demo. I know you can get a record deal right now." And then he kind of talked me off the ledge and was like, "No, I really want you to be on it." And so then I did my vocals. So if you go back and listen to that version of Rodeo Clowns, you hear like Jack's vocals panned on either side, and then my vocal down the middle. And then it was his song. And so later when he made his second record, he recut it.
I love stories like that in the music industry and business. I mean, when artists along the way, they're working with other artists, and there's so many stories like that. I think it looks good on you. I don't know.
That way you won't lose it.
I think we all want a pacifier just occasionally. Or a bottle, for that matter.
Wait, Amy, I'm gonna put him inside real quick.
Okay. So let's go back to the album, The Juice. You put that out right before COVID hit, and it was Grammy nominated, and then right after that, COVID happened. Were you able to tour at all before COVID hit, or were you just shut down?
You know, we did our first half of our winter tour and got through like the East Coast and Midwest. And then we had 2 weeks off, during which my 2-year-old Garrett Cass was born, and I had foot surgery. And then, so then he was born the 13th, and then the 28th, we hit the road to do the West Coast. And then that was right before that was when you heard like the coronavirus, and there's a case in Seattle. And meanwhile, we're starting in the mountains and then working our way up the coast to like, oh, now there's a case in San Francisco. And then we played the two nights at the Belly Up in San Diego. And then I had a day off. I went to LA because I had to do some business up there, and I called up my friend Citizen Cope. And we went out in Venice, had lunch, which turned into happy hour, which turned into me keep saying, I'll get the next train back to San Diego. And then finally got the last train back to San Diego, and it was starting to get pretty weird. And then we played Santa Barbara. So the day we got to Santa Barbara, we got the call saying, tonight's the last show. Everyone goes home tomorrow, which was March 13th. And then that was it. And that was the day that like lives in infamy, because that's the day that every band in every country or around the world like basically got sent home. You know what I mean? So, and then we were home, and it was like, yeah, it was like, wow, I just put out like this amazing record, which we had worked on for years, and it felt really great. And just got shut down.
Well, let's talk about the new album, because Philadelphia, Mississippi, I love the name of the new album and kind of what it stands for. Were you writing that this last couple of years? And what kind of gave you the idea for that concept? Because I know that it's a combination of the Delta and also the sounds that you grew up with in Philly. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, Philadelphia, Mississippi, the album is the pilgrimage of the hip-hop blues. So, and again, the story kind of took place in COVID because I was off the road doing different kind of shows and away from the band that were stranded in Nashville and Portland, Oregon. I reconnected with my drummer friend, Chuck Treese, who's an iconic Philadelphia area musician. And Chuck's played with everybody. He was the original member of Michael Franti's Spearhead. He's been in Special Sauce. He's been in The Roots and The Goats. He's been in Urge Overkill. He's been in a lot of projects, Santo Gold, a lot of stuff over the years. He helped people get going. And his own band, like Mick Rad, and he was in Bad Brains and everything, blah, blah, blah. But anyways, Chuck and I reconnected and did our duo show. And we're doing the backyard parties, like I said. So we had some income, and I didn't want to come out of like the pandemic, like empty handed, you know, that was part of it. Like I made a Christmas record, and then I had this idea to do this Philadelphia, Mississippi record, because when we got the Contemporary Blues Grammy nomination, and that was the lane Contemporary Blues, to me, I finally found a box to fit in, right? Which is what people always wanted us to do from marketing perspective, but we never fit in any box. But the contemporary blues works so well because it's just everything I do. It's taking this this roots music, iconic blues is everything part of American music, and taking it and pushing it forward into any direction you want to go with it. So that's perfect for me. And so I said, I'm staying in this lane and I want to do a record where you guys are in Mississippi. And so, you know, I hit up my old friend, Luther Dickinson, whose father, rest in peace, Jim Dickinson, produced my second record. Luther and Cody and I have been talking about doing something for years and years. Well, I hit up Luther. I said, well, let's do this. Can you host us to do this record called Philadelphia, Mississippi? And I want to get all these blues players to come in, emerging young men and women, blues men and women that I kind of connected with on this, these blues cruises I've been going on, because I, oh my God, all of a sudden my eyes are open to this younger generation of blues men and women that are like in their 20s and younger, that are like completely authentic and completely pushing the boundary of the blues and paying homage to what was there. So if you were ever wondering, like, was the blues in danger, like dying, it's like, hell no. Like, cause there's, you know, Criston Kingfish Ingram and Jontavious Willis and, you know, Tekira Jackson of Memphis's own Southern Avenue. And then they got established older guys like Alvin Youngblood Hart, who lives in Memphis. And guys like Cedric Burnside and his guitar player, Trenton Ayers, who's on the record, and Cam Kimbrough, Junior Kimbrough's grandson, and Sharday Thomas, who's Othar Turner's granddaughter, the Fife Master, and all these people that are right down living in the Memphis, North Mississippi area, and that the, you know, Luther and his family have been a part of, and, you know, kind of community gelling family for the, for those, that blues community, the Hill Country Blues, which is right there. So, and because of the fact that it was the pandemic, everybody was off the road, right? So everybody was home and everyone was out of work. So everyone was down to have a day at work. And some of the people that came through the studio knew who G Love was, and some had no freaking idea. And then also R.L. Boyce, who's in the neighborhood too. And yeah, it was just a magical session to get to share music and songwriting with all those people for a week. It was unbelievable.
So you laid the tracks down in Mississippi, did that part of it, and then you took those tracks and you went back up north and you added some other spice. What was going on up there?
Yeah. So when we cut the record and it was like, wow, like in 5 days, we had 10 guests come through the studio and everybody like took it to the next level. And, you know, and the record was playing out kind of just as it was conceived, which was like a blues, a hip hop blues record. Right. And so then we realized, like, well, there's some space, there's some opportunities here to get some MCs on it. And yeah, you know, like we had trouble kind of getting, we originally were trying to get some Memphis based MCs, but we were having a trouble attracting some MCs to the project. So we said, well, let's give it some thought here and kind of like take it back to Philadelphia. And so then I just started thinking about some of my friends, like, so Schoolie D is like the originator of gangster hip hop, and like his older daughter and my older son used to play together as kids. So like, I know Schoolie, like we party together and hang out. So I hit up and we've never done a record together. You know what I mean? And I'm like, And we have a song called Love from Philly. And I'm like, holy shit. Like, yo, school, I got this track. Oh, hell yeah. I'll be down at the studio. And then I said, well, one of my biggest influences in hip hop is Speech from Arrested Development. We toured with them in Europe in the 90s. And we caught up about 10 years ago on a plane home from the festival in Japan. And follow each other on Instagram and stuff. And I'm like, God, let me just call Speech. Speech is like, yeah, I'll do it. Oh my God, Speech can be on a record. And then Chuck Treese is like, yo, I'm gonna hit up Freddie Fox, who's like this really like hardcore New York rapper from the 80s that I know from like the Boogie Down Production records. And I was like, Freddie Fox, are you serious? Like, and then he was like, yo, Freddie's gonna do the record. And I was like, oh my God, this is crazy. So yeah, it just it was unbelievable. And all those guys just like brought, everybody that added, that joined in the collaborative process on this record, just lifted up what was there previously. It just kept getting higher. You know, it was really cool.
Some really cool tracks on this. Love from Philly, like you said, which is kind of a hip hop tribute. And you've got My Ball, Laughing in Sunshine. Tell me a little bit about, just in general, the kind of the music and where your head was with that.
Couple of the songs, actually some of the ones that you just mentioned were some of the ones that we kind of had prepared pretty well and leading up to the session. And Chuck and I did a songwriting session in Tennessee on the way down. We had a couple of days off and we wrote that song Laughing in the Sunshine, and we actually did a really nice writing session for 2 days, and it was really collaborative effort between Chuck and I. And he actually did a lot of lyrics for the first time since I've been writing with him. And it was just flowing. Laughing in the Sunshine was just, you know, it's just what it is. It was just, I had the idea for the song called Laughing in the Sunshine. And we just started a little groove and he started flowing this cool lyric, you know, some bum in the pack, sunshine in my back. I got some friends now, they know where it's at. Yeah, the music playing, pushing, no delaying. I got the move, can't stop to what I'm saying. And it was just like, you know, about a good summertime classic. Love from Philly, I had got tapped by, it was actually an online festival during the pandemic called Love from Philly Fest. And a lot of big names were on it, including Schoolie D, myself, and like John Oates, and a lot of people, and to raise money for Philadelphia area artists. And they tapped me to write the theme song. So I had written that chorus and that was hot. So then I wrote verses. And then Chuck wrote his verse in the studio. And My Ball was a song that I just kind of, hi buddy, that you can have that. Bring it over here. He stole a popsicle out of the freezer. But my ball was, that was a celebration of my wife. Rap that I wrote, you know, just talking about how awesome my wife is. And then it was cool because that was the song that Freddie Fox was on. And we think of Freddie Fox as an MC is very hard historically. And it was really cool to have him write a verse celebrating his wife. And so that was cool. But yes, and then the last thing I'll say was that a lot of the writing happened on the spot in the studio. Because everybody that came in was kind of tasked with bring a riff or a hook or, you know, like a verse, to have something kind of like in your head that you want to do. And we're going to come in and write a song. And that was part of it, too, to get to attract people to the session, was that if you come into the session, we are going to be songwriting together. So although we cannot pay you a ton of cash, we're going to pay you some money, but the incentive that we're going to write together and we're going to own this project together. Right. So that was part of the business incentive to engage on the project as well.
So lastly, I want to mention that you're releasing this as an NFT, right?
Thank you. Yes.
And tell me a little bit about that. I had to go down the rabbit hole actually to figure out what this was, but it's very cutting edge. So I wanted to get that in. It's very cool.
Yeah. So we're kind of looking overall, I think, at the next evolution of the music business. And if we want to think about the last one happened in 2001 with Napster coming out in the age of like digital piracy, which led us now into streaming platforms. And now we're going to talk about Web3 on the blockchain and just a couple few basics. What is the blockchain? Well, you can think of it as the new internet. Okay. So we want to really break it down to layman's terms here. An NFT is a collectible. So if you as a kid collected like comic books or, you know, Beanie Babies or Smurfs or baseball cards, and you had the notion as a kid, well, I'm going to buy this and flip it. That's how people are engaging in NFTs right now. So it works because people believe in it, and there's a community of people that are trading in it, and they're making and losing and buying and selling money. And so music on the blockchain, why would you buy G Love's NFT? Well, if you like to support what I'm doing, you know that if you bought the NFT, 90% of those royalties are going to come to me and my team so that we can continue to fund projects and, you know, pay for this, making of this record. And so it's a great way to take out the middleman. Just know that if you spin records on Spotify, we surely appreciate it, but just know that we don't get paid on it really. Like the labels ended up doing huge deals with Spotify and Pandora and all the streaming platforms, but the musicians really didn't see any of that. So it's harder and harder forever for musicians to kind of justify making a record because you're just not going to be able to sell any copies, right? So we hope that the NFT is going to like really like kind of break through and bring back ownership to the musicians and artists in a different genre. And also the last thing is that because it's a collectible, right? There's always the opportunity that you could buy my record or someone else's record. And it would be, because it's like a limited edition kind of thing, that you would be able to flip that and make money at that. I'm not promising that, but I'm just saying that's what's happening. People buy and trade NFTs. So it's going to be interesting. And I'm proud to say that we're like the first blues album coming out as an NFT. So it's I like juxtapositions, Amy, and this is a juxtaposition between like the oldest form, you know, American music and the newest form of American music, hip hop, and you know, this newest technology. So our NFT comes with 4 digital variations of the album artwork. Some are animated, and also comes with a rare gold vinyl that we ship to you. So you get to stream it, you get to download it as well. So you're getting everything you want, except for you're supporting the artist directly.
The album is amazing. It's Philadelphia, Mississippi. It's so creative. You're an amazing artist. We wish you the best of luck with the album. Can't wait to see you. Let us know when you're in Memphis, and we'll come by and say hi, and you can come by and say hi. But we really appreciate you stopping by and talking with us about the album.
All right, folks, that does it for this edition of Insights. Thank you so much to G-Love for dropping by today to chat with us about his latest studio album, Philadelphia, Mississippi. Get out there on the internet or get to a record shop near you and secure yourself a copy of this genre-bending, Delta Blues-flavored piece of magic. And don't forget to share about what you heard on the show today with your friends and encourage them to support G-Love on his musical journey. He's got a relentless appetite for touring. He's been doing it all his life. So get out to a show as soon as you can. From all of us at Diddy TV, thanks again for tuning in today, and we hope to see you again real soon, right here on Insights.